If I thought that any of this would be used, I would abandon the film entirely.
Gentlemen, I'm the Amazing Randy.
The Amazing Randy.
The Amazing Randy. Ta-da!
A conjurer, prestidigitator, liar, cheat, and fake.
The life of Harry Houdini reads very similar to the life of James Randi.
If you're going to get your head cut off, you go to the best guy. Amazing Randi was the best guy.
Randi, you've been going around the country trying to debunk those who say that it's psychic power.
I can't think of that technical term. Oh, yes, bullshit.
What I do is bending or breaking objects.
Uri Geller pulled the pants off them. It was astonishing.
Bend. Look.
Can you do the spoon bending trick?
Does Dolly Parton sleep on her bow?
Do you know how many times Randy tried to ruin my career?
You've been taking a lot of medication.
Peter Popoff is a very dangerous man.
In the name of Jesus!
Popoff just seemed to be able to hear the voice of God and know all about people.
John 3784.
He wondered how he got the information.
I dressed as a security guard.
I appeared in disguise.
Randy is trying to say this is a big hoax.
Duh. I'll take 2 8 right then.
That man that puts the fear of God into all those psychics. The Amazing Randy!
The easiest way to be bigger than yourself is to lie.
He was terrified.
A man who's devoted his whole life to uncover real deception has at the center of his life a deception.
Only one of these people is sworn to tell the truth.
What a situation. No matter how smart or well-educated you are, you can be deceived.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core of the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and what you just heard was the trailer for a documentary called An Honest Liar. Now, I first saw this trailer about a year ago when they were running a Kickstarter campaign to raise funds to finish up the movie, and it just looked like an absolutely incredible story to me. Spoiler alert, it is. And tonight, we're lucky enough to be talking to one of the filmmakers behind this picture, Tyler Meesom, who's also a huge, huge fan of Infants on Thrones. Right, Tyler?
A bit. I've heard it. Yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, you might have to cue me in every once in a while. Sure.
Yeah, okay. So, anyway, sit back and enjoy the conversation with myself.
Hi, this is Glenn.
Bob Caswell.
Hey, Tyler, this is Bob. This is my voice. I don't know, what should I say about myself? I'm an infant on a throne.
That's all I need.
Okay.
Our own sort of amazing Randy Snyder.
Well, James Randy's, like I've told you guys many times, he's one of my heroes. I'm big into skeptical. I'm big into the skeptical community. And James Randi's a god in the skeptical community. So,
yeah, he is.
And he's really interesting.
Yeah, no, there's no two ways about that. I think I know the man better than most any other human alive. So yes, I understand.
And Captain Matt Jack Long Sparrow.
Hi, Tyler. I'm Matt, and enjoyed your film, even though I think I owe you some money for it.
Oh no, did you pirate it?
Well, I didn't, but somebody that I know I think did.
That's okay.
And they provided it to me.
Well, I would be. Has anyone not seen it?
We're assuming most of you haven't seen it. At least not if you're listening to this within the first few days of its release. But as soon as it opens up at a theater near you, go and watch it, because it's really, really good. And if you don't believe me, take Tyler's word for it, because I could listen to this guy talk about his passion projects forever. His enthusiasm is just super infectious. So thanks for coming on, Tyler. Take it away.
Has anyone not seen it? We've all seen it.
We all have.
Oh, great. Okay, that's good.
I think
that's
it was. Great. It did it air on BBC? Because at the end of the movie, It sounded like Next on BBC.
It did, and that's probably where you found it. The BBC bought it well in advance of us completing it or even coming close to completing it. They did what's called a pre-sale, a co-production, and part of it was that they get to show it at a certain time, a certain, you know, and unfortunately the film took longer than we thought based upon elements that happened within the film.
Is that towards the end when yeah. James got a little testy there?
Yeah, and so we unfortunately we had to let them air the film. Now they did change the title to Exposed: Magicians, Psychics, and Frauds, or something of the like. But it did kind of preempt any kind of theatrical or other screening. But you know, that's okay.
So is the version that you're releasing this weekend the same, or is it different than what was on BBC?
It is. Oh. It is different. Mostly it will be longer. It'll have more elements in it.
Well, then you'll get money from, you will get money from me.
Yeah, me too. Okay. I definitely want to see it.
That's all right.
It's funny because one of my thoughts after watching it was thinking certain parts I wanted more of, and now I'm intrigued to see if the new cut like matches my desire, because it's all about me, matches what I want.
Well, we'll do a recut for you if you'd like.
Great, perfect.
Yeah, it'll be like Blade Runner. We'll just keep doing different versions until
until everyone's pleased. Right. No, it's not too different, to be honest with you. It's just got a little more. I think they cut it back by 7 or 6 or 7 minutes, so it's different, but not completely.
Cool. Well, I want to get into the movie eventually, but maybe we could start off. You know, I'd like to hear a little bit more just about you, about your background,
sure.
and how you got into being a filmmaker in the first place.
Me too.
Sure. Yeah, of course, guys. I am a full-time documentary filmmaker. And I'm very, very fortunate to be such, because when I was 10 years old, I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker.
Was it because of all the awesome Mormon movies you saw?
That's exactly what it was. Together Forever definitely set me on the path. Okay. You know, it actually quite the adverse of that. It was, well, not so much the adverse, but it was Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark that kind of made me want to be a filmmaker for whatever reason. But it was definitely not something that my Mormon parents wished that I would do. And of course, when I said I want to be a filmmaker, of course, they patted me on the head and said, of course, you're going to be. But when I pursued it, I think they were a little bit surprised and in some ways kind of kept me back from it. Yeah, I think so, just a bit. You know, and yes, I was raised in Pleasant Grove, Utah, Manila, out in the middle of nowhere, to a Mormon family. I have a very large family, 5 sisters and 1 brother. You know, and albeit we're a very creative family, it definitely wasn't something that I was pushed to do, to be a filmmaker. But you know, I did everything I could to learn about it and study it wherever and whenever I could. And when I was in high school, I made a silly little commercial for drinking and driving, not advocating it, of course. and it did very well. It took it fourth in a national contest. And then I started, well, I went on a mission, and that's a whole different shitty podcast, but no, actually, I won't say that, because I got to tell you, like, people often ask me, do you regret going on a Mormon mission? And I'm actually quite torn, because I will say that I was a very effective salesman for the church, and what I did learn is that if I can sell that product, by God, I can almost sell anything. And it really taught me how to sell and to convince people, which is the majority of what a filmmaker does, is effectively parlays your passion and belief into someone else, be it an actor, a producer, a cinematographer, whatever it may be. So I do think that it was a 2-year crash course in many ways in that. However, I was also something of a disobedient missionary in so much that I rented a lot of movies and read a lot of books I wasn't supposed to. In many ways, it was as it should be when you're 19 to 21 years old.
In other words,
cultural...
you were normal. Yeah.
exactly. Except I wasn't getting laid like most kids do at that time. As far as you know, I didn't. And so someone,
masturbation is a form of being laid.
Oh, whoa.
There was a lot of that, gentlemen. So it was.
And kinda, where did you serve, Tyler?
I was in Missouri Independence. So I was in Kansas.
Oh my
and
God.
Nebraska and Iowa.
I just moved from Jackson County.
Oh, really?
Lost yeah. Some.
You'll go back there someday. Nonetheless, I did kind of have a cultural awakening in many ways there. I came home and started working on film sets as a grip, a PA, production assistant, production design, you know, many, many areas. And then I made a short film, belief-based. I had, by this time, for the most part, left the church or was in the process of leaving. That short film garnered me commercial work, which I was very happy to do at a time when commercials were being paid, filmmakers were being paid very well to do commercials.
Were you at BYU's film school, or where did you go to school?
You know, I didn't go to BYU, and I was fortunate never to have to even want to do that. I did go to a little bit of Utah Valley University. But the fact of the matter is I was really already working in the industry, so I didn't feel the need to kind of continue. I regret some of it in many ways. I regret not getting more of a business degree, I believe, because I found consequently that filmmaking is more about opening a business than it is about lining up shots.
So you just dug right into the industry, and it wasn't like you went to USC Film School and went the traditional path.
No, I feel I'm something of an autodidactic about the film world.
Right.
I just kind of threw myself in. When I made a short film, I raised the money for it. I wrote a script. I rallied my friends and family and people to make one with me. And I had a roommate who went to BYU Film School, and I remember him having to watch like Battleship Potankum or something. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to watch Caddyshack again. That sounds much more interesting to me. But I will say I think I've watched more films than most anyone I know. I really just kind of, you know, overdosed in film books and movies and learning everything I could about them. So after doing commercials for a while, I made a couple of other short films. And then I made, with a partner of mine, Charles Oliver, we made a film called Take, starring Minnie Driver and Jeremy Renner, that did rather well in the festival circuit. And then I made Sons of Perdition, which you may know. It's on Netflix. It did very well. It was bought by Oprah, and it played at dozens and dozens of film festivals all over the world. And it followed three boys who were kicked out of their polygamist community.
Oh, I've heard about that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. It really is, and I put a lot of my life and time and effort. And in many ways, it's my partner Jenny Lynn Merton and I. We did it, and we'd both been kicked out or had left the Mormon faith and had to deal with that and disappointing family, friends, and community. So in many ways, it's our story writ large. Obviously, we didn't have the same difficulties that polygamist boys and girls do, but in many ways, we do. So,
yeah, just what was that?
It was a bottle of whiskey. I'm pouring myself a bottle of glass. Is that okay? No.
Are you okay?
Is that okay?
Of course.
I had heard. I guess I just need to watch the film, but I've heard Sons of Perdition, not the Lost Boys. Often end up in the streets turning tricks for food.
You know, that may have happened a couple of times, but by and large, I think that's an extreme case.
Okay.
For the most part, they just become 16-year-old boys who don't have a mom and a dad. They really kind of cling to each other because of the way they were raised. They automatically don't have a trust of anyone who is outside of the community. Like a lot of people who leave faith, they just need someone who understands what they're going through. Wow. We followed three boys for 2.5 years. And during this period, we watched them as they learned about the world they knew nothing about, very little about. And we watched them as they rescued little sisters from marriage and tried to get their mothers out. And we witnessed a lot of pain and suffering, but in the end, they really kind of figured out their lot in life. You know, it's one thing to leave Colorado City. It's another thing to leave Colorado City in your mind and to accept and be aware that, you know what, I'm not going to hell. And everything that I've been taught is wrong. And that's more what the film is about, that spiritual arc of coming to grips with not having that kind of overbearing religion on top of you at all times.
Right.
Yeah.
This documentary gig, though, I mean, because you implied earlier that you know James Randi about as good or better than anyone. I mean, you spend a lot of time with these subjects. What's that like? And I mean, is that something you like about it, or is it a little bit of a burden?
Well, that's something I learned by doing Sons of Perdition, and I learned it because of Jenny Lind. And I think women are much more patient than men, anyways. I mean, there's an element where when you stay with a subject for so long, it's a lot of times when you're making a documentary, it's just because you don't have the money to finish the damn thing. But also, you know, when you go over to somebody's house for the first time, they clean up. When you go over to somebody's house for the 20th time, they don't care. And that's what we wanted to see. We wanted to find them for real. We wanted to see them as humans. And even the boys in Sons of Perdition, they, you know, when we picked up a camera, they very much knew that a camera was around. But after a year, they didn't notice it. James Randi, you know, he's lived his life in front of cameras. And when we showed up with a camera, he was the amazing Randi. It took a year and a half for us to see James Randi. And there are two moments in the film when you see him really become not a performer, not a magician, but a real sad, distraught, hurt, and worried human being. And that's, I think, the essence of really sticking around for a while. You know, if you're going to make a film about war, by God, put on a flak jacket, I believe.
Right. Wow.
So how do you make it work? Because I know, like a traditional movie, there's a production schedule and it's like everybody flies in, catering 30 days or less, and boom, you know, and then post-production. But what you're talking about is like, you know, putting your life on hold for these beautiful moments that may come once or twice in the course of the next 2 years. That seems like crazy, but awesome. How do you make it work?
You know, when we were doing Sons of Perdition, and Jenny and I were together at the time, we're still wonderful friends, of course. One night we got a call, and there was a boy we were following. He's 17 at the time. His name's Joe. And he desperately wanted his mother to leave the community. She was in a polygamous marriage, and she wanted to leave. And one night they called, and they said, she wants to leave. She wants to leave tonight. And so we literally got in the car, we grabbed the camera, and we drove all the way down to St. George doing excessive speed to follow this story. And it was one of those amazing moments in the film that when we started it, we said, God, wouldn't it be great if we could get someone leaving? And because we were around and because they trusted us, we were able to capture that. And it completely spun the film in a different direction. And those are things you just don't plan or know. Now, with the case of James the Amazing Randi in the film An Honest Liar, you know, we were by and large going to tell a story of a man's life. He's lived 85 years of a full and rich and remarkable existence, and we were going to kind of follow the history of it while we watched him as he interacted with people throughout his day and career. But what happened, and I don't want to reveal too much to those who haven't seen the film, while we were making a film about deception, you know what? I'll just tell him. I don't think it hurts. But while we're making a film about deception and a man who has spent his entire life trying to expose deception, a deception at the center of his life, of James Randi's life, was revealed. A lie that had been kept, a major lie that had been kept for 26 years, came to light by way of the FBI and the police coming to his house. And what that did was just completely spun the film in a different direction.
Did that alter the you know, eventual name of the documentary?
No, we had that name prior to it.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, it is fortunate that in many ways what transpired was part of the theme of the film. It's about deception. It's about keeping an identity. It's about when is it okay to tell a lie.
Right.
And this lie that was revealed leaves you wondering, did he do it? And should he have done it? And is it okay to do what he did if he in fact did it? How's that for being vague?
Well, my answer is if a lie protects an innocent person, then it's your obligation to lie. So,
well,
I mean, that's kind of a general statement. And in this case, it's a little bit more nuanced. But, you know, from the story that was told in the documentary, and it's a very interesting story, it was really difficult to judge the perpetrator of the lie in his life.
Yeah.
And how much time do you spend mining video media? I mean, because you've got that scene of the game show in the 70s that really sets up what you're talking about perfectly. Like, I can only imagine when you found that, you were like, yes.
Unbelievable. I remember the exact moment seeing that, and I am not joking. I got chills.
Yeah.
For the listeners, he's referring to an old episode of a show called To Tell the Truth. And Randy's partner, Jose, spoiler alert, Jose was on that show. And the announcer of the show basically says, you know, only one of these men is sworn to tell the truth. And I remember when we saw that, and when we first saw it, it was on an old, really crappy VHS tape. And I remember getting chills. I remember just going, I can't believe how many elements, just the cyclical elements of lying and identity, and a man who took on the identity of another man in order to take on the identity of another man to play another man was on a show pretending to be another man with a, you know, it's just, it just kind of like, I don't know what I did right to deserve.
yeah.
Right.
And it's terrible. Look, it's terrible. What happened to James Randi is awful. And I love these people. Like, you spend time with them and you love them. And when something happens, first and foremost, you're a human being and you go, oh my God, that's awful. That's terrible. And then secondly, as a storyteller, you go, oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I don't want to feel like an ambulance chaser, but we definitely did tell that story. And I will give kudos to Randy and Davey for being brave enough to let us tell that story and to continue to film in the midst of this life crisis.
Right.
Well, I mean, it was interesting that it went that way. I was certain that the bulk of the documentary was going to be over Randy being in the closet. It seemed to kind of hint at that real early on with Penn saying, you know, this is a man who's tried to keep a lot of things, living in secret and kept a lot of things hidden. And then there's a scene where you reveal real early on that this guy ends up being or is his partner early on. So I thought, oh man, I didn't know that. That's new information. And so that's what the honest liar is. But then that really was just in the background more than anything else, I thought. And I wonder if that was intentional or if you see it that same way.
No, you know, and it's quite odd because that was something we had no intention. We actually did not in any way try to hide the fact or notion that he was gay. You know, we actually – it's surprising to see how many people think that was the deception contained within the film, because it really wasn't. I mean, I think what's strange is that you don't expect it. You see a man who's in his 80s and he's with another man who's in his late 40s. And it's kind of an odd relationship anyways. So it wasn't something. And then we thought about it. We're like, well, maybe we should say he's gay. And then we just like, you know what? It's a modern world. You know what I mean? He's gay. It's okay. We don't need to make an issue of it. But he did, and this is another element of deception in many ways, that he kept this lie for 81 years of his life.
Right. I mean, I don't know if you can call it, I don't know if it's fair to call it a lie. It's just his business.
It's a different
It's not like he was walking around with women to try to perpetuate that he was a womanizer for all these years.
No.
It was just wasn't something that anyone needed to know about. And it was like it was welcomed in the skeptical community with a big meh.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a different time, obviously.
I mean, it was a different time, and you wouldn't expect that to be out there. And
so let's back up a little bit, because we may have listeners, I'm sure that we have listeners that don't really know. I mean, obviously they haven't seen the film, so they don't really know who James Randi is. So maybe spend a little bit of time talking about his background, where he came from, you know, the Harry Houdini connections, that sort of thing. Because I think that's some important backstory that we haven't really hit on yet.
Sure. Well, James Randi is known as the Amazing Randi. James the Amazing Randi, and he was a world-famous magician and escape artist, I would say probably one of the greatest of all time outside of Harry Houdini. And James Randi lived his life very much like Houdini, in that he was a remarkable escape artist and did all kinds of fabulous escapes from straitjackets and, you know, from being locked in boxes underwater and handcuffs and you name it. And much like Houdini, James Randi became the foremost debunker or exposer or investigator of paranormal claims. So much like Houdini, he went after faith healers and spoonbenders and psychics and mediums and anyone who was using the tricks of magic, his beloved magic, not for entertainment, but rather for deception. So James Randi would try and expose these individuals and not just say that they're wrong. He would orchestrate these massive Ocean's 11 type endeavors where he would conclusively prove that these people through, you know, were being deceitful. And he would do it through technology and creativity and just being very passionate about the work that he was engaged in. He was 86 years old, and as I mentioned, he's an 86-year-old gay man, and he's still very active in what he does. He's very much a figurehead of the atheist and skeptic community.
Yeah, he is big, and he has a meeting called the Amazing Meeting, or TAM, every year in early July in Las Vegas. And it's an amazing meeting. He also, I don't know if you know this, but he was a very close personal confidant of Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson, people didn't know, was a very, well, he was atheist and he was a skeptic.
He was also an amateur magician as well.
Right. And so at the time, the biggest con artist in, one of the biggest con artists in the world was a guy named Uri Geller. or as I like to call him, Uri fucking Geller. And Johnny Carson had Uri Geller on, but to do a demonstration of a stupid spoon bending trick. And Carson called James Randi and asked him, "What do I need to do?" And you can YouTube it. It's the most awkward 5 minutes you'll ever see.
Yeah, it is, and it's in the film. We show that now. It's funny because a lot of people know Uri Geller and don't remember James Randi, and that's unfortunate. But Uri Geller was probably the first superstar psychic, and he would do simple tricks like he would bend spoons or forks or guess what is in an envelope. And Randi hated him. I mean, these two just did not get along at all. And they continually battled each other in many ways. Both trying to get each other's goats. And while they were continually, during the 70s and 80s, battling against each other publicly and on television, I dare say that both of them led to each other's increased fame. Because every time Uri Geller would be on TV, James Randi would be on the next week showing what he did.
And Uri says that. He says, "You guys keep trying to do this, and I just get more attention from it."
Right. Oh, he loves James Randi, and he said it.
He
thanked, he to us. We filmed him, and he thanked James Randi for – he has this – we shot Uri Geller. We went to his house in England.
What was that like, by the way? I mean,
he's good at what he does.
Yeah.
He is one of the most charming, charismatic individuals. He spoke very well. Right off the bat, we let him know that we don't believe you. We're making a film about James Randi, and it didn't seem to bother him. What he says is very well thought out. He showed us he has a massive Cadillac, and it's covered in bent spoons. And we filmed him. We did not put it in the movie, but I know, right? And he basically thanked James Randi. He basically said, because of you, I was able to buy this. And we obviously didn't show that to Randi.
Well, you know what's funny? What's funny is that was one of the strongest messages to me in the movie. And I don't know if it was intentional or not, but the whole point of Uri Geller being like the poster boy of fraud and deception, but it not really mattering, you know, the fact that he's been debunked, he's been called out, he's been exposed, but it's like, meh, he still does fine. Big deal.
James Randi has a quote he uses all the time, a quip. It's more like he says these con artists are unsinkable rubber duckies.
Yep.
He says that all the time. It wasn't in the film, though. I was expecting that to come up sometime.
No, he did say it, and we had a cut where we put it in, but we had to take it out at some point just for time. And but it is true. It is. And people like Uri Geller.
Or Peter Popoff came right back.
God, awful. We used to like Peter Popoff.
Yeah,
but
that's the piece of shit that I want. I got – I had a just a strong reaction to. I wanted to punch him in his fucking face.
Well, you should. And what you are referring to for your audience members is during the 80s, James Randi went full force against faith healers, and it was very popular at the time. You know, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of pseudoscience and new ageism was very popular, from crystals and UFOs and mediums and channelers and spoonbenders and pyramids. And, you know, it was a very popular odd time, and the whole Time Life magazine or Time Life. You remember those commercials of like all the psychic abilities and all those things? It was a very popular time. And so Randi was this Don Quixote fighting, tilting at windmills against this massive, this massive belief during that period. One of the things he went after was faith healers, and they were very popular, and they were making a shitload of money. And there was one gentleman by the name of Peter Popoff, and Peter Popoff would have these massive tent revivals, and he'd stand up and he would call people out by name and address. And he would say, Becky Smith, you live at this address and you have arthritis. And then he would heal this person. And he was making millions upon millions of dollars. Well, what Randi did is he knew it must have been a trick. He knew that this guy wasn't receiving direct revelation from God. So he made this his cause. I mean, he followed this guy around the country, and he had plants in the audience, and he dressed up, and he hired investigators. And I mean, we barely go into it in the film about how in depth he went to follow this guy. And eventually, without revealing too much, he found out how he did this, and it was very simple, very deceitful, and in my opinion, just disgusting that he was doing this and purporting that he got it from God.
Oh, and to look at the faces of the people in the crowd, it just broke my heart in some way of, mm-hmm. Number one, how much this meant to them when it was just total bullshit. But also just how gullible they were. It's saddening. It's despairing almost.
I watched so much of that footage, and I watched so many people over and over and over, and I watch all of that, and it broke my heart to see women bringing their children, in crutches, and to see human beings throw their pills, literally throw their pills on stage. Because they didn't need their heart medication anymore.
That was that scene was so powerful, and I don't know if it's anxiety or
just kind of this panic as this is happening, just thinking, oh my gosh, all these people are throwing their pills, their heart medications, all these pills because this charlatan, this con man is telling them to.
Yeah.
And not only that, these are not people with lots of disposable income.
Right.
No.
That's preying on.
And there's a kind of behind the scenes documentary we had footage of, and there's elements of it in the film, but I wish we could have shown more of them, because there were people that you could tell were poor, and the interviewer would say, how much money do you give? And they go like, every penny we have, every spare cent we have, we send to him. Peter Popoff at the time was making about $6 million a month.
Whoa.
Now that's 1982 money. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money that people are giving him.
How did he go bankrupt so quickly then? If he,
I believe, and Randy believes the same thing, that it was something of a ploy to get people off his back and to not claim where the income was coming from, because by and large, his mass majority of income was cash, cash-based, so...
No, wow! Did you try to interview him? I'm assuming he declined, but I'm just going.
No, we never even tried.
You never even tried. Okay.
We just decided that, look, he's a bad guy. I'm sorry. We don't need his side. And I know that we may have needed to get his side, but you know what?
Like, no, you don't.
He's cut and paste. What he did? Yeah, exactly. What he did is just, what is he going to say to us?
Right.
You know.
You know,
he probably would have said no anyways.
The part of that story that I found so interesting was the way that James Randi revealed him, and on Johnny Carson's show, it looked like before that clip was shown that even Johnny Carson hadn't seen it or wasn't aware that no one else had seen it. Was that part of a was I misreading that or
no? You're right. And Randi tells a great story about it. That Carson liked to know everything that was going to be on the show, but Randi said, just trust me, because he wanted to see the surprise on his face when he revealed what he had been doing.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And then back in the 80s on network television, he cussed Johnny Carson.
Yeah, no. And then there's a shot of Johnny Carson just smoking in the film, just full on, okay, we're back. Just cut back from a commercial, and there he is, just puffing on a Marlboro.
Wow,
that's funny. Different time.
That was really interesting to see Johnny, his maybe not so veiled disdain of Uri Geller, and just kind of his bemusement over him struggling was, oh brother, wow, geez,
yeah.
But he was also very. Talk show host. He was also didn't want to antagonize. What I will say in watching that is, I mean, it was probably, even if you get on YouTube, it's not the full clip. I've seen the full clip. It's 20 minutes. It's like 20 minutes of show of Uri Geller like trying to figure out how to do it. God, that would never last on television nowadays. You know? They'd have him on for 4 minutes and then he'd be done.
Today's executives, TV executives, they would have been shitting their pants.
Right.
Minutes. I actually thought that this is you brought up one thing in the documentary that I wasn't aware of was the conning the scientists. Because for those who don't know, Uri Geller was conning two Stanford scientists, which is just so disappointing. that could happen. So James Randi, and you talk about the ocean. I think this was his biggest Ocean's 11, and then also that was interesting. It presented kind of a moral question. Was this a moral thing to do? And I thought that was a really interesting question to ponder.
And that's something we consciously tried to put in the film. Is the level of deception, the gray areas of deception, and questioning when you are lying and. You know, even if you can justify one lie on your side, it hurts somebody on the other. And I'm sure that Peter Popoff, this faith healer who was healing people, believed that he was doing good and justified it. And on the same element, what James Randi did was there was an element. There was an episode in the what was that 79 when a large amount of money was given to a university to do paranormal research, and it was given by James S. McDonnell, and James S. McDonnell owned McDonnell Douglas, the aircraft manufacturer, and he, oddly enough, wanted to figure out why test jets were going down and crashing, and he realized the best way to uncover this information would be to communicate with the dead test pilots, right? So he wanted to fund paranormal research in order to communicate with dead test pilots to find out.
That's kind of funny.
Because his null hypothesis was that dead test pilots exist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course.
And want to tell him, hey, so thanks a lot. Like, they want to fucking talk to this guy who put him on the plane that went down. Anyways. So he gave $500,000 to this university to study paranormal research. Now, this pissed Randy off. So Randy reached out to him and said, look, let me help you. You need a magician if you're going to test these psychics. And the researcher said, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. We don't need your help. And so Randy said, oh, sure, you don't. So what he did is he found two young magicians, and they applied to be part of this psychic test. And the Mac Lab is what it was called, accepted these two young men. So over the course of 2 years, 4 years, excuse me, they tested these two guys, Steve Shaw and Mike Edwards. They put them through a battery of tests. They bent spoons. They bent rods. They affected photographic film. They read minds. They moved objects. They, you know, just a ton of things. And at the end of it, they conclusively proved this paranormal research group said, yes, psychic abilities exist. And what they didn't know is that this whole time, God, I'm giving away the whole movie, aren't I? You don't need to go see it.
I tried to ask the question in a vague way, but then you just took the ball and ran right down to the deep.
Well, it's hard to start without finishing it up, you know? The three-act structure. Anyways, go see the movie to find out how it ends.
Yeah.
For those who are listening, us describing it does not do it justice at all. And one of the two guys end up becoming a really famous mentalist called the Vanacek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably the best mentalist in the world, I think. But we show, like, these two spent 4 years, these two young boys spent 4 years fooling people, lying, just completely making scientists believe that they have psychic powers. Now, did they do it for a cause of goodness? Yes, of course, on our side. But they also ruined careers. They wasted a lot of people's money and time and energy. So there are elements of deception. And when is it okay to tell that lie?
So what? I've got right. Two different questions, and one of them is at the beginning of the project, and one of them is at the end. So I'm curious how you got interested in this in the first place, and then I'm also curious what James Randi thinks of the end result of it.
Yeah. I had come out of Sons of Perdition. And it had done very well. It had played all over, and it got a lot of press, and Oprah bought it. And it was really nice to be a part of a film that was important and meant something, because we really did help a lot of polygamists. I worked with the Texas Rangers and the Texas Attorney General to build a case against Warren Jeffs. I introduced them to witnesses that testified against him. Mm. So if I've done anything right in my life, it's helped put away a horrible human being. But after that kind of high of doing that, and then, you know, and showing this film, and then one day it ends. And I believe that if you're going to make a film or write a book or write a screenplay, especially if you're going to make a documentary, it takes so much of your time and passion and heart. And there's not enough money involved to make it worthwhile unless it's something you just absolutely believe in. Documentaries are hard. And so I wanted a project that I could really sink my teeth into and that I loved. And I did not know about James Randi. However, being raised as a Mormon and at this point really coming to grips with my atheism and really questioning the existence of God and belief and really going through this period, somebody introduced me to James Randi as a person. And as someone who spent the early part of his life being lied to as I felt I did being raised in Mormonism, whether knowingly or not, and then consequently actually pushing that deceit on others when I went on a Mormon mission, I was very interested in a man who has spent his life trying to expose deception and why he did that. Why does this man spend his life trying to say no, you know, be the wet blanket at the party and say you're wrong and this is wrong and magic powers and God and psychic abilities does not exist. So I instantly knew I'd had to make a doc about him. I reached out to the gentleman, a friend of mine and I, who introduced me to the subject, named Thomas Guthrie. He's a local filmmaker like myself. And we reached out to him. They properly vetted me, and they said, yeah, do it. I met Justin Weinstein at a film festival, and he was a former scientist. And we teamed up. We basically, after about an hour of meeting him, I said, let's do it together. I didn't even know him. And 4 years later, we made the film.
Wow.
Whew. Second part of your question, which was you wanted to know how James Randi, what he thought about the film. Now, you know, James Randi lived his life thusly for us to make a documentary about him. Fortunately, it was us. But he saved everything, and he lived a very rich life. He saved every piece of paper. He saved every letter. He saved every file, every newspaper he'd ever been in, and he recorded every television show he'd done. And he had boxes and boxes of material. And when you turn that over to something of a complete stranger and you invite them into your home, you know, that is a brave risk. But he wanted his legend told. He wanted, at the end of this very exciting life, to kind of recap it and say, this is my documentary. The first time I met with him, the very first time we sat down, we had lunch, and he said, I will do this documentary under one condition. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh God, he doesn't want us to say this. He doesn't want, you know, he wants us to make him look taller. I don't know what he wants, which is hard because he's like 5'2" or something. And he said, I will do this under one condition, warts and all. Warts and all, he said, I want you to show everything. I want you to reveal the real me, which for a filmmaker to hear that is fantastic. Now, there's a scene in the film, and this I will not give away, but there's a scene in the film that is a massive turning point, and it is very... there's a reason. God, I wish I could say it, but I can't. But well, you know what scene it is. You know what scene it is.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But it could be when that film is shown, James Randi could be very, very, very upset at us. And when we showed him the film in a rough cut, he was very upset at it. He was very upset, and eventually he realized why that scene is in there, because it is a deceit both to you, the audience member, to us, and to him, and really is, you know, the climactic moment of the film. So, by and large, he was a little worried about the film itself. Consequently, he is in love with it. Yeah. He loves the movie. He travels around the world with it. He is very happy that it is introducing an entirely new generation to James, the amazing Randi, and reacquainting an old audience with him.
Do you know if anyone's picked up the torch and carried forward what he does? Or I mean, you said he's still actively doing it in his 80s, but I'm wondering in this new generation if it's spawned more people interested in this sort of stuff.
Well, Randi, I think he's done more than most people realize. So many people have come up to us and said, James Randi has changed my life. I was in a cult. I was a born-again Christian. I was spending money buying crystals, whatever it may be. And he opened my eyes. He changed my life. And I know that he relishes in that. He was a big deal in the 70s and 80s. He was really much popular than people give him credit for. As for now, there are a number of people that are really taking the torch. I think Adam Savage, who is in the film, while he doesn't overtly go after faith healers and spoonbenders, he has a public soapbox with which to say, you know, there are a lot of crazy myths out there. And with science and testing, you can find out if they're true or not. He's also on the board of the James Randi Educational Foundation and is a huge fan of James Randi. Jamie and Swiss is another one who's kind of running with what he's been doing. You know, people even like Darren Brown, who, you know, if anyone knows of Darren Brown, the phenomenal British mentalist, gets people to question. And I think that's more than anything, that is what James Randi has done. He's just
certainly Penn and Teller with Bullshit and the show that they've done.
That, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think right now, I think what it kind of reminds me of the question of when Carl Sagan died, who's going to pick up the torch of the great science communicator? And really, Carl Sagan was just Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Nobody could say, okay, I'm the next Carl Sagan. We got Neil deGrasse Tyson, which is, and it was a lot later when he came to prominence, but he's known as Carl Sagan. But the world is different. We don't need like
racist Carl Sagan.
I love Neil deGrasse Tyson. I just don't like what he said about philosophy.
But about what?
Philosophy. He just basically shit on the whole entire field. Like, we don't need it anymore.
But he's okay with orthodontists, right?
He's a great science communicator.
Chiropractor.
Randi, with your caveats with everyone. I like most everything of this person.
Little known fact, you could do all the work Randi does with some mineral oil. Just
but back in the – can I finish my point? Are you guys done?
Yes.
All right. So back in the day when Carl Sagan was the great communicator, that there wasn't – he was it. I mean, he was the face of science communication. But now we don't really need another Carl Sagan like that, because, you know, we have the Center for Inquiry and we got all of this online, robust, skeptical movement. Basically there can't be another James Randi. He is singular.
No, there isn't. And I think – the reason is because he's so passionate about it, and he's such a great communicator, and he reveals truth through showing and through comedy, and also he was needed at a time when you couldn't research, like you said. You know, there's so much truth out there. There's so many. You can uncover any lie by just, you know, a few keystrokes on your computer. Of course, you can also be led to many other lies, but you know, I don't know if there will be somebody like James Randi. I don't know if we need somebody like James Randi. I'm not certain. I don't know.
When you reference in the film that he took up for kind of after Houdini, and I didn't realize I'd read seen a documentary or something on Houdini, and he basically did the same thing in his day as he went around really attacking these other. This the same type of thing that Randi did, just in a different time.
It takes a thief to catch a thief. And when you are a medium, and spiritualism was very big during the later part of Houdini's life. You know, there was spirit photography, there was channelers, there was mediums and mystics. And he knew their tricks because he could see them, because he did similar tricks, but on stage. So for him, it was very easy to reveal and figure out how this was done. Now, Houdini died prematurely, but if he'd lived longer, I think he would have carried that debunker or paranormal investigator torch a lot longer. And I dare say James Randi kind of spent his life trying to do what Houdini couldn't because he died so early.
Yeah, and his death was really weird. Didn't he challenge someone to punch him in the stomach?
No, unfortunately, he didn't challenge someone. That's where the lie is. Now, Houdini was able to take a punch. He would say anyone could punch him as hard as he could in the stomach, and people would do it. But one day after a show in, I believe, Chicago, a college kid punched him in the stomach when he wasn't ready for it. So he wasn't ready to prepare and prepare his muscles. And I think it ruptured his kidney. The problem is that Houdini, he went and did a show and then did another show and then took a train back to Chicago or Milwaukee or vice versa. went to bed, woke up the next morning, and then realized that something was wrong and went to the doctor. So, yes, he died by being punched in the stomach.
So, such a stupid way for a great man to die.
Well, it was a burst appendix, right?
Isn't that That's how I think what it was. Yeah, yeah, burst appendix, yeah. Right.
I know,
you remember that great line in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles when Steve Martin punches John Candy in the stomach?
Oh, I don't remember
that. He doesn't realize. After he burns the car down and they're standing in the street and he sucker punches John Candy in the stomach and then he turns around and falls down on the suitcase. And then John Candy goes, "You shouldn't have done that. That's how Houdini died, you know."
That is a great movie. The fuck scene is one of the greatest scenes of all time.
Yeah, it's such a great movie. You put the eternal optimist and the eternal pessimist, and you stick them together
on a roadie.
Make sure they never leave, and that you have the ripe pickings for a great movie.
So I actually was curious if you could paint this picture. How long did it take? Was it 2 years you spent filming Randy?
It was a little under 2 years.
Under 2 years. So in that 2 years, paint a picture of how constant are you in his life? Like how many hours a week? How many weeks a month? How many months a year?
Well, by and large, we were full time on it. And a lot of that had to do initially with a lot of research. And a lot of times we'd stop by with him and we'd interview him or we'd follow him around or he would go on tour and we'd follow him. Or there were interviews with other individuals like Adam Savage or Penn and Teller or Alice Cooper is in the film. So we were on it full time. And then in January of 2013, we hired the brilliant editor, Greg O'Toole. And he spent 6 hours, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, going through all of the footage and figuring out the story. And that's when it really started to come together. That was more work than anything else. I mean, that was two directors and one editor working around the clock trying to craft a story.
Okay. So it's not. I've got a little off topic here. Alice Cooper. Was he Mormon? Was he raised
Mormon? That's the rumor.
I asked him about that.
Oh, cool.
And no, he
that's great.
He was raised because I thought, you know, I had that in common with him.
Right.
He was raised somewhat Mormon. It was an offshoot of Mormonism.
Really?
Strang guy?
Yeah, and it's kind of one of those Mormon offshoots and of which I don't remember, but his father was a preacher in it.
He's also
a born-again Christian. You know
he is.
Right?
He is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. But I just heard the story of him going out on concert in, like, his father's garments or something.
It's a rumor. I don't think that actually all happened. Right. And they were dyed green.
Yeah, something like that.
I didn't ask him about that, but I've done copious amounts of research to find out.
Cool.
And couldn't really find out if that was true.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it isn't.
Right. Okay, I just had to take us off track for a minute.
I know, but that's a funny tangent because there is this like cultural phenomenon in Mormonism of like Steve Martin is Mormon,
right,
and Christina Aguilera is Mormon.
She was.
For some reason, they want this reflected glory, but it doesn't matter. I mean, she's not anymore. But there's somehow this like cred thing going on that it's one of our tribe.
Amy Adams.
Well, they want to appear normal.
Yeah.
They want to find anyone who has, you know, any kind of normalcy and attach themselves to it so that they can feel better about what they're doing.
Yeah.
So how was your experience? Because you funded this through Kickstarter, right?
A portion of it, yeah. And that's another reason, you know, you say that what we were doing, yes, we were filming at the time, but there's also a large element of just trying to find the funds to make the damn thing. Mm. And we funded it through numerous ways. One was Kickstarter, which we raised about $250,000 on Kickstarter. At the time, it was the fourth highest documentary. We also did some pre-sales, BBC, Australia, Sweden. And then we raised money through equity as well.
Wow.
Yeah, not easy.
So what's the release scope going to be?
We premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2014 in New York, and it played very well there. We've been playing a lot of festivals all over the world and playing rather well. People do love the film. We're very fortunate. We worked exceedingly hard on it, and I think hopefully you can kind of see the wizard behind the curtain and you can tell that this was not something that was put together in a couple of hours. It is going to be released in theaters come March 6th, which is but a week away, less than a week away from this moment. It starts out in New York and L.A., and then it rolls out from there. It opens March 6th at the New Art in Los Angeles. I will be there for a Q&A. And in New York, it plays at the Sunshine, and James Randi will be there. So anyone in New York, go see the film and meet the amazing Randi afterwards. He'll do a magic trick for you.
What weekend is that?
That's the 6th. The 6th of March in New York.
Oh, damn. I got to get a plane ticket.
You know, then it rolls out throughout the country, and you'll have to get on our website, but it's playing in San Diego and Pasadena and Portland and Kansas City. It's playing everywhere. It opens in Salt Lake City, my fair city of which I live, on March 20th. And I will be there for a Q&A. It opens up at the Broadway. Nice. Randi will be at some screenings. There's a few screenings in Florida that he will attend.
Any San Francisco love? No?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We're opening in Oakland and in San Francisco on, I want to say, the 13th or maybe the – I can't remember.
I'll
get on
it
the Anonymous Flyer website. But, yeah, we're opening up in two theaters in San Francisco.
Wow. I mean, there's so many interesting questions I want to ask, which probably nobody cares about but me, but just the logistics of doing a theatrical release and this rollout and what the expectations are. And, you know, you're probably biting your nails just waiting for things to come in terms of, performance or I don't know. I don't know how it works or if it's all said and done and it's not really an issue anymore. Or.
No, it's always an issue. And Justin and I mean, we love this film. We love this film. And there's a general laissez about distribution of late. A lot of distributors will come on and they'll buy a film and they'll take it and they'll show it in a few places and they'll make just enough money to make their money back. We never wanted that. We wanted to live above the store with this film. So we consciously turned down theatrical offers and we are doing it by and large ourselves.
Really?
We're doing it with a booker and we paid him. But we're doing the grassroots. We're doing the promotions. We did hire a PR team. But it's a lot more work, but it's definitely worth it to get into more theaters. Nobody loves your movie as much as you do. And we knew that. So we knew we had a cadre of fans that would go see the film. And so we wanted to tap into that resource and get it into as many theaters as we can and keep it in as many theaters as we can. So it's been a year since the film has been released. And it still takes up a significant portion of my day. And it's tiring in some ways, I want to be done. I want to make another film instead of, worrying about the child that I already had. I want to make another baby.
those missionary skills are coming in handy. I mean, do you have to talk to theater owners directly a lot and kind of be on the front lines of pitching it all the time? Or is that, more handled by others at this point?
It's mostly handled by our booker. But we are definitely doing everything we can to get into more theaters and get as much press as possible, get some butts in the seats. So, yeah.
This is a question I should have asked early on. Are you a family man? Do you have a wife and kids?
My films are my wife and kids. I do not. I'm a single father of a wonderful 15-year-old boy. But okay. I am currently available. That is not
ladies.
A plea. That is not a plea.
Or gentlemen. I didn't want to assume too much.
Yeah. No, it's ladies. It's ladies. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
We just added a gay infant, so we're totally down with that.
Okay, good.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, and this should have also been asked earlier, when the interviews, who were conducting the interviews, and at one point you hear a voice on screen, is that you? Is that somebody else? Who's doing that?
The on-screen voice in the scene of which you speak is a very important scene that we referenced previously, and that was Justin at the time. I was not there. By and large, we were shooting and doing everything together. We shot the film. I was the cinematographer on it. I love shooting. And we would kind of trade off. It was basically us asking the questions most of the time.
So when that scene happens, that
Whose voice is that?
That's Justin. That was Justin.
Does he call you and say, Tyler, holy shit, you're not going to believe this conversation?
No. In fact, we'd almost forgotten that scene existed because it was without giving away too much, we shouldn't have used that scene. So in many ways, that scene was not a scene. It was a conversation that was captured on tape.
Well, I'm going to say I was angry with you. I thought, what dicks?
You're right. You're spot on there. You're right.
I'm not going to deny that. You cover your ass by the end of the film, though, so you're fine.
Yeah. No, yeah. There's redemption.
And when I saw it the first time, because I wasn't there, and our editor found it and basically put it in the film.
Oh, wow.
And showed it to us in a rough cut, I got a little sick to my stomach. I got a visceral experience. I mean, I really felt – I didn't feel good about it. And that is why it's in the film, is because it takes the film to a different level, and it makes you question you as an audience member and us as documentary filmmakers.
Right, and this theme of transparency, honesty, all these things are – It causes the audience to experience them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's like a very, you know, in the moment, just in tune with what the whole movie's about, and then it sort of implodes on itself in a beautiful way. But then I don't know. I really liked that because I was upset too for all sorts of reasons in that moment.
As well you should be. I mean, it's a blatant, absolute lie. it is. It's a lie. And whether it was premeditated by us or Randy or, you know, fixed or manipulated, what it does is it makes you question everything. And there are seeds planted throughout the film where Randy says, be careful of documentaries. They lie to you. And be careful. And what we want to do is just say to the audience, you know, everyone lies. Everyone. We all spin personal narratives. We all question. We should question everything that's in front of us. And that is such a principle that I believe in, especially having been raised a Mormon. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when you're raised a Mormon, we are taught to evangelize. We are taught to stand up in front of an audience of people that are older than us when we're 2 or 3 years old and say very personal things and to say it with passion and feeling and to say it, you know, the Mormon church raises a white, middle class, articulate army and sends them out as a unpaid sales force. And that's what I was, and I was damned good at it. And in many ways, after leaving the faith, I utilized those same skills that they gave me in many ways, not against them, but to ask people to question what you are being told, what you are being taught. Because when I was being raised, you were not allowed to question those things. And that's the saddest element. And that's why James Randi is a hero, because it's not what he does. It's not how he says you should. It's just that he says, by God, question these things. If somebody bends a spoon, just ask you why. How do they bend that spoon? And if somebody tells you that Joseph Smith talked to God, just say why and how come and did he really? And if we all utilize those tricks and or tools that James Randi teaches, the world would be a better place. And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ.
Amen. Amen.
There was one really sweet moment that you captured I can't remember where the scene was, but you guys were outside, and it seemed like kind of an impromptu discussion. You probably have hours and hours and hours of footage of those kinds of discussions. one of you, I don't know which one it was, asked James, do you miss Jose? Because, you know, he was away on the road.
Right.
And his answer was every minute of every day. And
Because he's not here.
Yeah. And, you know, they love each other. They you look at this couple, and that's another thing in the film that it was very difficult because Randy's an old white man and Jose is a, you know, middle-aged dark skinned Colombian man. Right? He's a Venezuelan.
Or Venezuelan.
And you just think like they should never be together. Like it doesn't, it's weird. It's odd. And we consciously didn't bring light to it or make it sound look strange. But at the end of it, you just go, you know what? These two human beings just fucking love each other.
And
they just need each other. And they just care. And they do. I mean, they love each other.
And yeah, and I think that you did this on purpose. But if we could capture when people have the realization of the fact that they're a couple, and you know that the Amazing Randy is gay, it's at a different minute in the movie for everyone. Is my feeling, like, because like you said earlier, you never actually come out and blatantly or explicitly say, you know, for the older demographic, this man is gay. You just let people understand it implicitly and intrinsically based on, you know, the environment and the variables at play that you're showing and everything. And I really like that, and it made me wonder, like, part of me was like, did I get it soon enough? Am I cool? Did I, you know, or am I one of these people who at the end is like, he was gay?
A lot of people, it takes a while. And I'm very much, and this was a very much our motto when we made this film, is from Billy Wilder, one of my favorite directors. And he said, let the audience figure out 2 + 2 and they love you for it.
Mm.
Now, he didn't say, let the audience figure out, you know, 87 times 52.
Right.
He said 2 + 2, you know, make it simple enough. And if you let the audience figure out, they'll appreciate it a little bit more as opposed to being told. I think the essence of storytelling is, how long can you keep a secret until the audience absolutely needs to hear it in order to continue on in the story?
Right.
We, in telling this story, took a lot of cues from magicians. The film is about magicians, ultimately. And magicians, it's all about distraction and entertainment. But there's also an element with magicians where they make you think they're not going to be able to pull it off. And I've seen many magicians go like, oh, I don't know, this, I'm not very good at this. This may not work. I don't know. Maybe you picked the right card. Maybe you didn't. And so you're hoping, you know, you're intrinsically hoping that it will work. You know, when you go to a comedy club, you want somebody to make you laugh. And when you go to a magic show, you want them to be able to pull it off.
Right.
And so it's that element of like waiting until the audience can't take it anymore. Just show me how it was done. Reveal the trick. And we tried consciously to do that. How long can we not reveal a trick or not say how the you know, how the story ended?
Right.
Well, I thought the way by not saying it and just letting it be, it felt very, I don't know, it seemed like an advanced move. It felt very mature.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is 2015. You know, you never say, oh, by the way, and they're married. You know, this man and woman are married. You see things and you say, okay, that's his wife, clearly. And I thought that happened. And I enjoyed that piece of it, I guess. I guess that was my reaction, is it felt very mature than a lot of films would highlight. Oh, hey, yeah, guess what? He's gay, and not needing to do that. And that, again, not really being the focal point of the documentary. This isn't a documentary about the amazing Randy, you know, the amazing gay Randy. But that's what we're going to start. That's what we should start calling our Randy.
Well,
the amazing gay Randy.
Seriously,
it's interesting, Matt, because I think you learn about the gay factor, like, literally within minutes, if you so choose to. But it right. is a huge part of the story, because toward the end of the movie is when there's this focus on, you know, he's been keeping this to himself, and then he only came out, I think it was 2010 or in his 80s. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how it was phrased. And you know, it's embarrassing to admit, but when I heard it at that time, at that point in the movie, I thought to myself, oh, so I was right. Okay, so it's been confirmed to me. I assumed much earlier, because I thought I figured it out. But thank you for telling me toward the end, because I almost didn't trust myself. And now I'm like sheepishly making a weird thing out of it. But yeah, because it is matter-of-factly. And you just see it and you're like, oh, I think...
But we, you know, the thing is, we never... Honestly, for me to hear that, and I've heard that from a number of people, you know, all of us, the editor and Justin, we all are very shocked at that because we never tried to hide it. I mean, early in the film, we say,
yeah,
you know, they're together. Like, I met him in the library and it was really nice. And then Randy says, we decided we are meant to be together.
Yeah.
You know, so we never really hide that. But hey, it works for me. I'm happy. That's
no, and I loved it because it wonderful. Made me I mean, that's the assumption. That's what I went with. Oh, he must be gay. But there was like this uncertainty to it, or this like I didn't know for sure. And then later it was confirmed. And I'm like, of course. But I don't know. Yeah. One other question I had for you, Tyler, is what dictated the length of the movie? Because I feel like it's actually pretty short, which is a compliment, because usually movies can run too long. But in this case, you had so much material and so much subject matter and almost three different angles that you were covering at the same time that the fact that you kept it to such a short length was pretty surprising. And I'm wondering what that decision was like.
Well, you know, as far as documentaries go, it's actually rather long. It's 92 minutes. Right. And most typical documentaries are about 80 minutes, 82 minutes.
Should know that, Bob.
Yeah.
I was trying to say it didn't feel long.
but you're right. And I will say that we packed a lot into it. We definitely chose an editor, Greg O'Toole, and he'd done other really great films that had moved quickly. The Two Escobars is one of my favorite films, and it just packs a lot in. And he edited that. We really move a lot of information within that 92 minutes. Would that we could have made three or four movies out of it. And there were a lot of story elements that we had to leave out. I mean, for God's sakes, Alpha Project, where the two young magicians fool the scientists for 4 years, that was 4 years of deceit and break-ins and costumes and lies and secrets and comedy that could have, without question, made an entire documentary. The Peter Popoff episode could have made an entire documentary. We could have made an entire documentary just about James Randi being a magician, for God's sakes, an escape artist. And we made one film about all of them.
The Two Escobars, was that a 30 on 30 film?
It was. Yeah,
30. So, oh, that 30. Was the editor? Man, that's a great film.
Hey, and for the record, I was commenting on the version I saw, which I think was more like 82 minutes, Matt.
Whatever, dude.
No, I'm just looking forward to that extra 8 minutes, actually, because that's a huge deal. I think that I'm excited because I, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but actually, in documentary movie time, that's an eternity.
Yeah, that's a few years of somebody's life, right?
Right, exactly.
So, Tyler, you mentioned earlier that you're anxious to move on to your next project. Do you already know what that is?
I do. I'm fully engaged in a few projects. There's a documentary film that I produced entitled Jesus Town, about a small town in Oklahoma that puts on a passion play every year. And this year's Jesus is a closet Buddhist. It is a documentary. And it is
right.
It's hilarious. It's very – no, it's in the film. It's a very Waiting for Guffman-esque kind of film.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
It is quite a cast of characters, and that is going to play at the Hot Talks Film Festival. It's another in the films about belief and religion that I have done. I am very proud of another short documentary that has just been completed with Janaea Gaudette, who was the director that I produced and shot. It's called Elder. And it's a beautiful film about a gay Mormon missionary that falls in love with an Italian communist in the 70s. Amazing film, and I can't reveal which festival it will play at, not yet, but it's it'll be revealed very soon.
All right.
And then I am actually engaged in a documentary that's not about belief, believe it or not. I'm making a film about the rise and the cultural effects of MTV.
Well, we had a documentary we wanted to pitch you.
Oh, here it goes. Bring it.
Right, Glenn?
No.
You're
I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear it. Please.
No.
We'll get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah. the documentary, The Rise of Podcasting in the Mormon World.
You know, I have been considering and thinking about it and have been presented not so much doing something about the rise of podcasting in the Mormon world, but about the Mormon faith in and of itself and where it is at this moment, in addition to the history of it and the storylines that you know, of the early Mormon history and the prophets. And somebody's going to do it, and it's going to upset me because it should have been me in many ways.
Well, isn't that what Dutcher says about a movie about Joseph Smith? Is he wants to be the one to do that, kind of the same thing?
There's no way that is the right medium for the subject, Joseph Smith, especially in Nauvoo. You need a Deadwood-type series on HBO.
You're damn right you do. That would be my dream, would be to do a
– Glenn.
That's my dream.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's been my dream forever.
Wow. There's only one professional here.
Yeah,
I've been doing. True. I've been in a lot of pitch meetings about that. It's very big. It's a very big piece. But if you were to do a Boardwalk Empire type of series about the early church and westward expansion, and you know, you're putting together a. You want to talk about murder and bloodshed and sex and greed and deceit and socialism, all within. You know, the context of one town and the leader of one, you know, it's a remarkable story.
Right. And, and the,
call it Nauvoo.
Right.
I think you'd have to take a couple seasons to get to Nauvoo, but it's, I've been, fascinated with that idea for a long time, but
As have I'd like to do it. I'd very much like to do it. I think it would be, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. I've been pitching it around.
Do you have an opinion about some of the other LDS filmmakers? Is it a small community? Do you not really – is it irrelevant in your world, or do you guys bump up against each other, the Hailstorm and Dutcher and some of the other ones?
I'm thinking what's his name that directed Mitt? Greg Daniels, is that it?
Greg Whiteley, I believe. Whiteley. I don't know him. And he's made now what, 3 or 4 films. New York Doll was great.
That's
Sundance. Right. New York Doll was great.
Mitt, I did not care for at all, and not because I'm not a fan of Mitt Romney, but I felt it was boring and it basically skirted the issue of who he was. It did not reveal at all. Mm. It was essentially a long and boring propaganda piece.
Yeah, that's how it felt. Yeah.
I abhorred that documentary. I really just felt like it didn't really get to who he was, or even a political doc. You know, you want a great political doc like War Room or Street Fight, where you really get in and you find out who this person is and what they're running against. And that was basically just Mitt Romney, you know, showing that he wasn't a stiff millionaire. It's fucking awful. Anyway,
tell us how you really feel.
Right. Those are the kind of things I hate. If you want to make a doc, show me something, you know, reveal a human being, do something that is worth it. And I think with An Honest Liar, we did that. With Sons of Perdition, I'm not putting myself above anyone, but we lived with polygamous kids with Sons of Perdition. I mean, we rescued them. There is a moment where a 14-year-old girl jumps in our car and says, "Go, get me out of here." Wow. You know, you dig deep enough to make it worth watching. If you want to find out about something, and that's where I think he didn't. I mean, you ask a Mormon Republican to make a film about a Mormon Republican,
ugh.
You know, right. What else are you going to get?
Well, what about because we all, not all of us, but all of us that were on the panel went to go see Meet the Mormons in the theaters, and I brought a couple of flasks of whiskey to get through it, I purposely went on a Sunday with one of the other people that was on the panel, and it was empty. We had the whole theater to ourselves, and of course we did a 3-hour shit on that documentary podcast, but. Did you watch that documentary?
No, oh God.
You're not that masochistic.
I'm still behind on House of Cards. I do not have time to watch.
I just figured it was a documentary done by the church. I thought maybe there was a chance you were like, I wonder how bad this is.
No, I suppose I should have in the you know, to be objective, but I just had no interest.
No, it's not worth it. It's basically something that belongs in the visitor center.
Yeah. I'd heard rumors, and I talked to someone who was it was someone from someone, so who knows, but that an usher or a ticket taker, that they had sold out the screening, or they had projected that there were X amount of hundreds of tickets had been sold for these screenings that day, and in the end, nobody showed up. Very few people showed up. And so when it had these remarkable numbers, many people believe or speculate that the Mormon Church bought as many tickets as they could on Fandango in order to raise those numbers up.
No, you know what happened was they called down to the local leaders, the wealthy local leaders, to go do it. You know, the church's not going to spend their own money. They got a bunch of people that will spend their own money for them.
Well, there was a stake president letter. There was a bunch of scandalous type stuff just to, you know, there's this line of, hey, everybody go out and do it as family home evening activity. We want to, you know, it really matters this weekend because then Hollywood will take it seriously. And yeah, it's just kind of crazy.
Well, look, I'm doing the same thing. You know, our film comes out this next week and I'm reaching out to atheist, skeptic, you know, magic groups.
Yeah, so but you're not already taking you're not already taking 10% of their money, though. So that's the difference.
No, I'm taking 20. God, I wish I was taking it.
Wouldn't that be nice?
But to answer your question from previous, I know a number of the filmmakers here, and many of them are great filmmakers. Anyone who makes a film, I don't think people really understand how difficult it is to make a film and get it off the ground. It is hard work, and anyone who makes a film deserves commendation. Some of them make better films than others, but by and large, I think they're really good people making good films, and I'm happy to be associated with most of them. How was that? Diplomatic enough? Was
yeah,
that
right.
like that?
Yeah.
Was that good?
Good. It's like you've worked on that one.
Cool, guys. Well, I appreciate it. The film comes out, like I said, this weekend, and then it rolls out. You can find out more about it on anhonestliar.com and find out where the screenings are. And please go see the film, and especially anyone here listening in Salt Lake, please go see it at the Broadway starting on March 20th.
Nice.
I can't speak for the rest of the guys, but I can't recommend it enough. I either had emotional reactions that good film should do. It felt shorter than it was. It was educational. It was entertaining. I really, really liked it.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Four and a half stars, and that's
nice.
What?
Nice.
Jeez.
That's for
hey,
Bob.
I'm putting that on the DVD cover.
Yes. Yes. Woo! If it's on Thrones, gives it 4.5 stars. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Because you know what, Matt? That's actually what I gave it too. So.
Oh, look at that.
And I'm excited. You're screening it in San Jose, which is just walking distance from where I live. So that's perfect.
Yeah, the Camera Cinema, I believe.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we've already established, Bob, that most of what he does for you.
It's becoming apparent,
Just let me know when you want it to play, any times that are right. 5 o'clock on a Friday. That'd be fine. Well, cool, guys. I do appreciate it. It was nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for featuring me in the film.
Thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome, guys. Good luck.
Take care.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye.
Hey, dette Claudia Imwelv I Norge. Did you know that infants on thrones in Norwegian are called spädbarn på troner? Du kan kommentere denne episoden på nettsiden infantsonthrones.com. Og hvis du liker det du hører, gi forumet 5 stjerner og skriv en kort anmeldelse på iTunes. Det har jeg gjort. For all you non-Norwegian speakers out there, you can comment on this episode on infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating in iTunes. Er det noen som vil avslutte med bønn?
That means anyone for the closing prayer. I kind of just guessed.
How old are you? I just want to get a feel for what generation you're part of growing
up. I'm 43.
Oh, you're Glenn's age.
Yep.
Class of 89.
No, 90.
90.
Oh, 90. Yeah. Okay. Oh, you guys are one of those.
One of those.
We're Generation X, yeah. Right?
Is yes, it? we're the slackers, and we're proud of it.
Uh-huh. And you grew up in Utah, grew up in the Salt Lake area, or somewhere else?
No, Pleasant I grew up in Pleasant Grove. Yeah, so I was raised in Utah County.
I used to deliver pizzas for Pizza Hut to Pleasant Grove.
Maybe that's where I know you.
It's the only reason I know where Pleasant Grove is, because it was in my little delivery region.
Yeah, I know it because I took the canal between Orem and Pleasant Grove. It was great to bike it, and I had a friend in Pleasant Grove, so I used to go on the canal path. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
I do. Of course I know the canal path, of course. Yeah, I know. It's, you know, it was a nice place to grow
sure,
up,
yeah.
By and large. It was, you know, it's a nice place. It was an idyllic situation growing up where I did.
Yeah. Oh, Pleasant Grove. Even the name is like Pleasant Grove.
Yeah. How can Serenity. You bash the place, right?
So what made you stay in Utah? I mean, you're in Salt Lake, and do you like it? And does it work well for your business and all that stuff?
Well, yeah, you know, I do have a 15-year-old son here, and I'm happy, and he's wonderful, and you know, so that keeps me here by and large. However, I like Salt Lake, and I'm for the most part somewhat new to Salt Lake City. I lived in Provo for a decent amount of my adulthood.
Oh, yeah,
and then I was able to escape. I tunneled under the wall. I don't know how you guys got out. I've witnessed kind of this birth in many ways of Salt Lake City, and it feels Salt Lake City is this vibrant artistic community full of, you know, progressives and liberals and environmentalists and gays and artists, and Salt Lake feels like a teenager. In many ways, you know, like it's just growing and it's figuring itself out and it's telling its parents to fuck off and it's slamming the door. And you know who I mean by parents.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's just like this very vibrant feeling. And I think there's a lot of people, and I referenced it previous about how the Mormon Church taught me to be, you know, active and outgoing and engaged and gregarious. And there are many people like that who were raised with that Mormon ideology of capitalism in many ways and industrialism and evangelism. And then we become gay men or artists or, you know, or environmentalists. And we use that passion. And evoke it against what we were raised against. So it's this really great environment to be an artist in.
Wow, sold. I'm moving. That was a pretty good pitch.
Nice. But I also am very close to an airport and travel a lot. So that's nice.
Oh, that's helpful. Yeah. And it's affordable. I mean, relatively speaking, compared to California or the coasts in general. So there's that.
Well, people ask me, they say, how do you... You know, I travel a lot, and I go to film festivals and such, and they say, well, how do you like Brooklyn? Just assuming that I live in Brooklyn because I make documentaries. And I say Salt Lake, and they're a little astounded that I make documentaries in Salt Lake. And they say, how do you make documentaries in Salt Lake? And I go, I make documentaries because I live in Salt Lake, because it affords me the opportunity to take risks.
Yeah.
Because I don't have an exorbitant rent in New York or L.A., I can go 4 or 5 or 6 months without working in order to take jobs that I want to take, do films that I want to take, as opposed to doing shit reality shows.
Right, right. And that's part of the whole deal with doing documentaries, right? I mean, it's just kind of spikes. It's not like a steady paycheck. It's you're off and then on and then off and then on, right? I mean, you're always on in terms of the work, but in terms of the cash flow, it's not that way.
Well, you know, we still sit at the kids' table of the film world.
Mm.
We are definitely underappreciated. We work harder. We have more to deal with. And I will put it up against anyone. Making a documentary is harder than making a narrative, and that's coming from someone who's done both. It's really hard making a documentary film. It takes passion and heart and nights and weekends, and there's without question you are not compensated commensurate to the work that you put in.
Yeah.
But you know there are other rewards, I would hope.
Yeah, sounds like it. I mean, it just this movie itself. It's got to be rewarding, and it's great. It's great for me. So keep making them. I like
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. Well, I'll just keep it for you alone.
Oh, look at that.
Nice.
So how much money can be made in the documentary?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's do a 180. All the figures, don't you?
How do speaking of which.
You know, there are ways one can make money. If you're standing as a documentary filmmaker and doing it full time, you don't have a social life. That's what it is. You work very hard. I work extremely hard. I do. I give up a lot to be able to do this. But the rewards are numerous. They really are. I'm really fortunate to be able to tell stories and do what I want to do when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get to hang out with guys like James Randi and probably have his cell phone number, can call him up, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, if you want to put him on the show, you're more than welcome. I could probably figure that out. He loves talking.
Oh, my gosh.
Even more than I.
That would be, like, amazing.
Just let me know. We can set that up.
Let's go ahead and just call that an official request there.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Just to let... If you're going to try to book James Randi, let him know I was a guest rogue on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Nice.
He's on that show quite regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Obviously Stephen Novell is a huge hitter in the skeptical community. But
yeah, of course he's
just to let him know that he's not going to get ambushed or anything.
Yeah. Speaking of the skeptical community and ex-Mormons, do you guys know Mr. Deity? Do you ever watch Brian Dalton?
We interviewed him.
Yeah, he's great. Really great.
We interviewed him about 8 or 9 episodes ago.
Yeah, he's great, and I just talked to him today, actually. So he's great, really talented cat.
Yeah, he is so funny. Glenn and I got to hang out with him in person, and Sam
got that chance one time.
Sam Harris and Michael Shermer were there too, but it was Brian Dalton that was holding court in the room. He just everyone. He was the center of the attention.
I believe it.
So fucking funny.
Yeah, and Shermer's great as well. He's in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he's fantastic. He's a really sharp individual.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Actually, you have quite a long list of celebrities, and going through that process, you just call them up and say, "I'm making a cool documentary, and the amazing Randy's on board. You in?" Or it's probably more complicated than that, but. It's cool seeing Bill Nye and
Penn Jillette and Alice
Adam
Cooper.
Savage. Yeah,
yeah. Adam Savage may have been my favorite to do. He was. I mean, he's just a hell of a nice guy, just an insanely nice guy, and he has a shop in San Francisco, and it's basically this grown man's clubhouse, and he has. It's very museum like, and if you watch the film, you can see we shoot in his playhouse, if you will. I can't remember what he calls it, but and he has Hollywood memorabilia all completely and all around it, and some of it he's traded for, some of it is authentic. But what he does, he's very obsessed about Hollywood props and working on them, and he will basically recreate Hollywood props, whether it's absolutely to scale to detail C-3PO or the passports from Bourne Identity.
Wow.
Just almost obsessive. And while I was there, he was working on, do you remember the scene in Dr. Strangelove when they're in the bomber and he's relaying the kits that they have? Slim Pickens is relaying the kit that they have, their landing kit, and it has prophylactics and medicine and I can't remember what's in it. He was building one of those to exact specifications.
Wow.
He just built a replica of the maze from The Shining. So
The Shining.
The Shining. So he showed us all of that, and he's similar to Randi in many ways. James Randi is an 86-year-old man, and when you go to his house, it's like when when my son's friends come over. And you go to James Randi house, and he'll say, "Oh, come look at this. Hey, look at this. Come here. I want to show you something. And I want to show you a magic trick I did. And come look at this book. And come look at this toy. And look at this award I got." And that's how Adam Savage was.
Did you? I don't know if you listened to This American Life, but he did a segment a couple months ago where he told the story of his young adoptive son, you know, because he and his husband adopted a boy. and his son got old enough to know about marriage and, you know, this, that, and the other. And his son was absolutely against him, his two dads getting married. And just the way he told that story was so, so funny.
Of whom do we speak?
Adam Savage.
Oh, well, he's not gay.
Wait, who am I thinking? Oh, you. I was thinking of... Shit.
Dan Savage.
You just
Dan Savage.
Somebody.
I was thinking of Dan Savage.
We can edit that out.
That's a very different cat, bro.
Yeah, you're talking about the guy from Mythbusters.
Yeah.
Oh, Adam my Savage. God. I was thinking Dan Savage this whole time.
No.
Don't edit that out, Glenn.
Okay, Matt, I won't.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.